The thing that is AAA today will be the indie of the future. And then the AAA of the future is something we haven't yet even seen.
We haven't imagined it yet.
I don't know what it's going to be. Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be something that...
So indies will be making an Elden Ring in the future because they have all the tools.
Yeah, that's going to be like a 25-people indie team making Elden Ring.
I'm with Jussi Kampainen, a veteran game developer, VFX artist, and creative director from household names like Rovio. His recent work with generative graphics pipelines has captured the imagination of countless game developers. Jussi, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, great to have you here. Can we begin by hearing about why you got so interested in generative AI? Like, what problems did you want to solve?
It's something that's interested me always. Like, since I first saw any videos on YouTube about generative AI, I was captivated by it for, like, I can't really pinpoint why. It's maybe something that, as a technology, interests me. I've done a lot of procedural stuff. Everything I always do, I try to be as procedural as possible. So maybe that kind of was a trigger for me, because that's like the holy grail of procedural art is generative AI. And so, but the problem that it solves for me, like I think it solves for everybody, is just it enables you to work on projects that are out of your scope as a small developer. I think that's the main thing that I'm most excited about is what it will do for the solo developers or individuals who want to make something, but they are maybe don't have the team or don't want the team or just want to work on something that's out of their scope.
Well, let's drill down into that a little bit, because people have been working on procedural systems and games for years and years and years. I think the first procedural game that I ever played was probably like NetHack, and I think that's like 40 years old or so at this point. What's the difference between procedural technologies and what generative technologies offer game developers, players, etc.?
I think like the main difference between procedural is that it's a known entity. Somebody's controlling it. Somebody's precisely controlling it to do exactly what's required. It can be replicated. The process can be, it's predictable. AI is not. It's something that's hard to replicate your results. It might be impossible, or at least when talking about generative AIs and diffusion models, it's very hard to get the same results twice. Even with the seed number, it's sometimes impossible. And also there's a lot of just this black box where things happen, but nobody knows why.
That's interesting, because I spoke to a game designer earlier today who had done a lot of work on chat-based systems using GPT and whatnot. He's been building these games for the last couple of years. He said when he first approached it, the mind-blowing aspect was when he got there and they said, well, you don't really code anything, you talk to it. That's how you explain to it what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what do you mean you talk to it? This is like the holodeck from Star Trek. And then you find out that it's a little bit more complicated and doesn't always behave as exactly like you want, which is kind of what you're saying. Interesting way to think of this is like a team member who joins up, and maybe it'll become increasingly more that way as we end up with smarter and smarter AI.
Yeah. At the moment, it's a very stubborn teammate. Like, you might want something, but they're always not going to make it. And always it's based on the data set that's used to teach the AI. It might be missing stuff. There might be blind spots in it that you just can't get it to do something you want. But it's still a teammate. And if you're willing to work with its limitations, it's very powerful.
It seems to me that the people who are having a lot of success with it right now are figuring out how to deal with that stubbornness and get the pieces working with each other. So I think that's why some of the videos and whatnot that you've posted online have gotten very popular recently, which is because you've kind of figured out the steps and how they link together. And by the way, we'll put links to some of this material down in the show notes so everybody can find it later. I highly recommend that if you're a any kind of game designer, a producer, a person who's involved in the graphic systems of a game, you check it out. But let's spend a little bit time on some of the things you've learned in your own projects. Like you've got this game that you're working on. It's Echoes of Somewhere. That's what you call it, right? And you've been using generative AI for that. And you've kind of been building in public, sharing information about how the graphic system was set up. As I understand it, you started with Midjourney, and that was kind of like a way to create concept art. Can we start there? Like, what did you first learn about Midjourney? And then what did you figure out about the limitations? And how did you start building out a graphics pipeline from there?
Yeah, the Midjourney, let's see. I just stepped in queue for all of these generative AI tools without knowing what I'm going to do with those. At the moment, the Echoes game was still a low polygon game, like this retro style, very flat shading, because that was something that I knew that I could create myself quite quickly. I wouldn't need to spend too much time on the assets. Low polygon graphics, super easy to make, like this very, very solid, simple, solid colors. And I looked into AI because I was just interested in it. And then I went to, I think I got the invitation to Midjourney first. And I was able to work in there and try to figure it out. Midjourney was super interesting. When I was working with it then, I could see myself making a game using Midjourney. Like, it was very good for backgrounds, but horrible for characters. But I could get some kind of like characters out of it that were very messed up, but I thought maybe with clone stamping and brushing I could make the characters with Midjourney. And at this point, the Echoes of Somewhere project was with a different name, and it had stalled because I just didn't have enough time in my free time to make the art, so the project was paused. But I was looking into Midjourney, looking into if I could use it to make the graphics. And then Stable Diffusion came out that you could download on your computer and use locally. And I got that, and it was better than Midjourney. And then I started creating assets and the graphics with Stable Diffusion. And then Midjourney 4 came out, and then I went there, and it was better again. So it's been kind of this back and forth going from tool to tool to tool. But now that I've started working with Midjourney version 4, I'm kind of, I don't know if I'm stuck with it, but I kind of maybe shouldn't move somewhere else, because now I can have this baseline of just acceptable graphics that I can work on top of. So I think at least for the first couple of episodes of the game, we're going to do them with Midjourney. And I tried Dolly too, but Dolly the graphics it made were boring. It was very, they were very nice, but they didn't have the soul or the oomph that you could get from Stable Diffusion or Midjourney.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get some of the folks who've worked on Stable Diffusion and Midjourney on a episode coming up here on building the metaverse. But yeah, Midjourney in particular, it just creates great results. Like, it's at a point now where you can get things out of it that rival, you know, people who have been working on concept art for a good chunk of their life. Like, even someone like me can get a good result out of Midjourney. And it's pretty close to being game usable, or at least inspiration.
Yeah, very close. And my idea has been to embrace the AI for this Echoes of Somewhere, just to build the project around AI graphics, so that I won't make any decisions that prevent me from using AI-made graphics. Because maybe I should go into detail why the AI graphics is the thing that I chose, is that the project wouldn't happen otherwise. Like, I tried to do it for years. The game has been in my desk drawer for 10 years, and it hasn't moved. It hasn't advanced. With family, with kids, you have to spend time with the family, and then the work I do, I love it. So I don't have enough free time to commit to a project that actually like requires so much effort. So with AI graphics, this suddenly became possible to do.
Yeah, and you have a day job too, right? You have a day job. You're building a game for a big studio along the way. So We'll come back to that, but I want to spend a little bit more time on like your journey as an indie game developer, essentially, as well. So it sounds like you've had this idea in your head that wants to burst forth and take shape on the screen, and what the generative AI technologies have really enabled is for you to get some of these ideas out, start accelerating the process, and now it seems like you're well on your way to actually being able to ship this game.
It's so nice when you get to work and you want to make the game. And before, I would go in and I would have to maybe model a location, model trash cans, desks, drawers, cars, building walls, like all of these things, and build procedural sets out of them. And I made a level designer. I made a level tool that could build me interiors of houses procedurally. But it still was a lot of work to make all that happen. And with AI, I just sit down, I write some words, and then it gives me an option like, how about this game screen? And then I can just re-roll the same thing 20 times. And it's like 15 minutes later, I have a location. And then the location is not necessarily what I need it to be or what I want it to be. But if I'm accepting, if I'm like open to being inspired by the location, then they are perfectly usable. Like if I want a location with two doors and a table with like some statues on it, might not happen. But I might get a location with one door and a window and a bed. So then maybe we can write the story so that instead of having a desk, there's a bed. And so we kind of have to stay open to changes all the time. And it also gives a little bit of false impression of how powerful AI is. If you kind of embrace its stubbornness, if you don't try to force it, then you can get stuff done super fast and with like a impressive speed.
Comes back to that team member metaphor again. Like that team member really wants a bed to be in that room.
It wouldn't make a cupboard. Like yeah. It's like okay, all right then, we will do a bed. Yeah, I think at the moment, I think it's something that people might not realize is when they look at all this great AI art and it's filling up every place. And I'm against AI art being pushed everywhere. Like it's so, the volumes are so massive. Like I think there it's going to take a while for it to find its place where you can post AI stuff, and it's fine. But the thing that people kind of don't realize maybe is that they don't know what the artist's intention was, or the one who made the prompt. They don't know what they were after. Mm. Like, it might seem threatening, or it might seem something that's coming and it's unstoppable. But at the moment, it's mostly happy accidents. I don't know if all of it is happy accidents, but it's mainly happy accidents. But I don't know how long that's going to last, because the tools, the control net, and all those things are so advanced already. So maybe this year already AI will stop being random generator and be something that you can totally control.
Well, let's come back to things like ControlNet and some of these technologies that enable, you know, more specific generations, and also some of the tools and that you've assembled into your pipeline. But before we get to that, let's spend a little bit of time on people that are maybe just entering game development or VFX or any of these fields that you're super familiar with. I've been sharing a lot of this content, and you can see some of the comments that I've received. People will say stuff like, oh geez, I've been like studying at college to learn shader programming or something. Have I just been wasting my time, or is there even going to be a job for people like me in the future? I'm curious, like, what your overall take is on that. Like, what do you think the impact of these technologies are on people that do graphics and design and game development specifically?
If we imagine that AI will take over the jobs of those junior level positions, I think what it would mean is that people just start up one peg above. So you wouldn't start up as a junior, you would go in as a lead. So instead of taking your first job in games company as like a junior game, like maybe junior shader artist, you would lead a team of artificial intelligence shader artists. Maybe that would be the case. And then what about all these junior positions? Like there's only so many companies. But when the labor is cheaper because you don't have to pay everybody, there's many more companies. Like I believe that the things, it will just multiply the like now we have one company with four junior artists and one lead. In the future, we might have four companies with one lead in each company working with AI to produce the art. I kind of feel that life will find a way. Like there's been so many times when there has been disruption in technology where people have been worried that it will take our jobs. And it's true, it will take a job, but it will produce many more jobs, like steam engines, internet, maybe even just telephone, car. I don't know, when people invented horse, where people who walked, where they're saying that we never have to walk again, like it's going to take our job. Like, for sure. Like everything, always with new things coming, they will destroy jobs. They will disrupt industries. They will make positions in a company obsolete. But they will open up so many new doors and open up so many new doors for possibilities. Like, what if game budgets were slashed in half or in to the fourth? That would mean you wouldn't have to have so much. You wouldn't have to earn so much with the game. You would be able to. Yeah. To you wouldn't need to have so high sales. You could sell a game, maybe 400,000 copies, and that would be amazing with a team of four people and then endless AI artists. What I'm trying to come to here is that you could take more risks. You could make products that wouldn't please the major population. You could make products that please a very niche part of the population. So it would open up, it would make people be more bold with their decisions and more crazy with the experiments.
Right, because if you're going to spend 10 million or 20 million or, geez, in AAA, $100 million to build a game, it's, you know, going to attract a certain kind of capital that's going to support that. And while there are exceptions and people that do want to take big, big risks with that, the more capital you're raising, in some ways, it often results in lower risks being taken in the overall system design. Whereas if there's a lot more.
Yeah, if you look at the AAA market, every game is pretty much the same game. Of course, the story is different. The characters are different. There's maybe one new mechanic. But at its core, it's the same game usually. Even if it's third person or first person, but it's a similar game. Like you have a competition between FPS shooters, but they're all basically the same game. Like if you have to describe how the game goes, like just the base of it, it's always the same. But maybe in the future we can take more risks and veer out from the beaten path to more of this, like these weirder directions, and get the games that we do in the future will be like one step above. Like the thing that is AAA today will be the indie of the future. And then the AAA of the future is something we haven't yet even seen.
We haven't imagined it yet.
I don't know what it's going to be. Yeah, it's going to be something that.
So indies will be making an Elden Ring in the future because they have all the tools.
Yeah, that's going to be like a 25 people indie team making Elden Ring.
Yeah, or maybe even fewer. Maybe it'll be, you know, Echoes of Somewhere will be the team that does that someday, and it'll be one.
Yeah. And it's impossible to say, but I'm really interested in seeing, like, I kind of in my head, I know what the indie games will be, like what the low budget games will be. They will be the same games that we play today, but instead of being made by 250 people, they're made by 10. But what will the 250 people do in the future? That I really want to see. Like, what crazy stuff is going to come from the big studios that are going to utilize AI to the full extent of it? Like, it's going to be mind-blowing.
In your own area of expertise as a creative director and a VFX artist, what would you tell the person who's maybe college age right now, just thinking about or hoping to get into game development? Like, what are the skills they should know, like right now, to enter a game development studio with relevant skill set, given what you're seeing in generative AI?
It's quite easy today because you can get an engine like Unity or Godot or Unreal and start learning. So I think a really good option is just to make games. Just make games on your own at home. And you don't need to publish them. You can just post them on YouTube maybe. Just have something to show. And then don't shy away from junior positions or like, I don't know, there's this debate on is internship, like free unpaid internship, is that something that should be even considered? Is that like, but that's a valid path to a games company.
The number one thing I always told people when I was running a game studio before I was focused on the infrastructure of building games, which is what we do at Beamable, I always told people, you have to have a portfolio of examples. Game development is very, very hard to enter this field. So it's really hard unless you're able to clearly communicate what you're capable of. And that means sit down in front of Unity or Unreal and just start making things and don't worry about it so much. Don't worry about putting it online and worrying that someone is going to like it. Everybody knows that you're just starting in your career. They'll be impressed that you're the one out of 10 or maybe one out of 50 people that actually makes things and puts it online, because that's what it immediately sets you apart.
Yeah, yeah. And it's even if you want to be VFX artist, you do VFX. Learn how to do VFX in a program. There are so many good resources to find education online. If it's video VFX you want to do, there's YouTube tutorials for that. It's mainly that YouTube is a great place to learn. It's an amazing place because it has so much content that you can just enjoy. Like that didn't exist when I was learning these things. We didn't have YouTube that we could look into. Like you'd have to look at it yourself, like find everything out yourself. But kids these days have it so easy because everything is on YouTube or somewhere else on the net. It's so easy to find, and it's just go find that and then do the work and then publish it somewhere. It doesn't need to be amazing. It doesn't need to be the best you can do. It's just as long as you have stuff you can show and then apply for a realistic position too, of course. Like you are unlikely to get a lead level job in a company with your skills that you're just kind of developing yourself at home, but you can get your foot in. And one option is also like one thing that is very important. You don't need to go to the right position immediately. You can go into games company as an office assistant. You can go into games company as a game tester, or you can go into games company as a cleaning lady or whatever you want to go in. Once you're in there and you start networking with those people and then you start talking to them and you start showing your stuff, at some point, they will have an open position for a job that you're going to apply. And then you have already your feet in the door. You have been getting paid for this while you, even if it wasn't your dream job, like it might be possible to, like that happens so much where people just shift roles in a company all the time.
Yeah, 100%. I hired an office manager once, and after a year or two, she ended up getting hired on as the producer for a game we were working on. I hired a customer service person who ended up going into QA and then from QA into a game design position. So these things happen, but you probably want to start by hanging out with the people that you want to emulate a lot. And if the people you want to emulate as game developers, start being with game developers all the time. It'll make a big difference in your life. I guess my take on this whole field as it emerges with AI is, first of all, you know, everyone's always super optimistic about how these things are going to play out. Everything is always harder in game development than they initially look anyway. So this stuff is probably going to be harder to put into practice in some ways. But I guess the biggest thing, I guess, from just my own standpoint, and it matches what you were just kind of relating, is, you know, there's so much material out there for you to learn the state of the art in a field. So whether you want to be a VFX artist or a game designer or a coder or whatever it is that you love doing around game building, metaverse, simulations, virtual worlds, whatever it is, like there's the things out there so that you can effectively speed run your way to the state of the art in any field. I think that should be the aspiration of anyone right now. Get to the state of the art fast. Start actually building stuff that is using state of the art. The AI tools will then help you at the boundary of that. You'll start to see where AI helps. Don't worry so much about like replacing. It'll replace the things that are kind of not state of the art anyway. You don't want to be doing those kind of tasks. So you've been putting stuff online about the generative pipelines you've been creating. So let's take a little bit of time just to step people through like a basic graphics pipeline that you could actually sit down and build for yourself today. Maybe a good place to start would be the work you did taking Midjourney assets, bringing it into FSpy and then Blender and then bringing it into Unity. Maybe talk through for people like what you could do if you're watching this and you want to try out some of the stuff that you've been demonstrating online. What should people learn?
Projection mapping is the name of the technique. So it's an ages old technique. It dates back to like the, I think it might even be one of the first things that you could actually do that if you want to do VFX for film. I don't know, maybe like projection mapping has been out. It's been here forever. And it's basically what you do is you take your image and you imagine like if you had a video projector placed exactly where the camera is, and it would project a photograph on a surface. And then you had another camera that you could move around and it would feel that there's actual depth to it. Of course there is actual depth to it, but you kind of get for free all the lighting and all the little details in there. I've been doing projection mapping for forever. I think I started to do the technique in 2005 on some animation stuff. We did the background for the animation with projection mapping where an artist would paint a background and then I would model it and then we could add some camera movement in it. So it would feel 3D, but it was actually just a 2D painting. Once I got the AI tools and I wanted to use it for games, I didn't necessarily need the projection mapping first. But I figured it would be easier to place the game content in the 2D image if it was in three-dimensional space. Once you get the image out of Midjourney or any other tool, it could be a photo, it could be a drawing. It doesn't need to be AI. It can be a watercolor painting or oil painting or whatever you want it to be. All the techniques are the same after this point. So then FSpy is a tool that will figure out the vanishing points in the image, like the perspective of it. With a couple of guidelines, it will give you the camera position and the focal length and the FOV of the image so that you can start placing 3D meshes on it. And FSpy very nicely integrates into Blender. So if you go into Blender then and you open up the file, you will have the camera set up and you will have the image as a background in your viewport. And then you can just start placing boxes and squares and flats and whatever things in the scene. And you just start fleshing it out. I found a couple of tutorials online on this topic, how you can do projection mapping and actually on a Midjourney image. I think they started popping up like a couple of weeks ago, which they kind of outline my workflow exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Which was really nice. So I could then just share those instead of having to do a full-on tutorial myself. I could just point people to like, hey, this is a video online. She does exactly the same thing that I do. And she explains it way better. So those are really nice places to go if you're looking for the pipeline. It's very simple. The pipeline is very simple. You have a 2D image and then you figure out the vanishing point in the image. So that you can start placing geometry into the image and then project the image on the geometry. And if you don't move your camera at all, you can get away with very simple geometry. If you want to have a moving camera, then you need to model all the details in there and make sure that everything is detailed so that when the camera moves, you don't get the flat perspectives kind of revealing that it's just an image.
So you see, you covered a lot about this, the art and technique of projection mapping. A lot of the work you're doing, it seems, in your indie game project is kind of bridging the gap between this 2D world and the 3D graphics world. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So that's something that I've done quite a lot in my career. I've done puppet animation, I've done live action, I've done hand-drawn animation, pretty much any technique that you can think of, I've done at some point. Maybe it's been a music video or a TV ad or a game or for a film. And most of the time, you have to match techniques. You have to have something that's a puppet animation, and then you have something that's 3D. Or you have hand-drawn stuff, but some things in there are 3D or particles. And you have to make sure that these different styles don't stand out from each other, but they match together. So with Echoes, I really wanted to see how far I could push matching the AI backgrounds to anything 3D on it. It would be reflections, lighting, how the depth of field effects work with the characters and the backgrounds, and the atmospheric effects, and little blinking lights in the background. Try to bring the background to life so that it feels more than a painting. So I've kind of approached this project as if it was like a video production instead of game production, because I've been able to use compositing techniques and things that I've learned in a linear media like animation or movies to apply them in games to blend the background and the foreground together, which has been a really nice kind of a marrying of these two facets of my professional life, games and animations, and kind of very nicely tied to use techniques from both of the professions.
Maybe that's another role for generative AI is providing like a glue between some different domains that ordinarily you wouldn't be able to bring them together as easily, because you'd always need that other person who like shuttles code and content between the two systems.
Yeah, it's possible. And there's many steps in Echoes. At the moment, AI is only helping me with the 2D stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's more tools coming, and there's many layers to the things that I need to do. For the background image to be actually usable in the game, I have to overpaint stuff. I have to do manual editing to it to kind of isolate things that then I can use for the 3D rendering. It would be nice if there was an AI that knew how to do those things to speed it up even more, so that there would be less for me to do this grunt work and more I could just focus on the big picture and focus on selecting the background, and then it would basically be just usable instantly in the 3D scene.
You could imagine a future where there's an AI that's going to somehow figure out a lot of the projection mapping step for you, and then maybe it even figures out, based on what it's seeing in the scenes, like materials and lighting setup and stuff that could be automated through code and Unity. Like, it, based on what I'm seeing, it looks like it's all coming, and it's coming at us pretty fast.
The 3D projection mapping thing, I think, is very close. Like how to derive depth information and then turn that into a mesh. There's already tools for that. The meshes are still quite poor quality. They are maybe too low res or too high res, so it's hard to get this perfect mesh. But when the camera is not moving for a thing like mine, I think the automated tools could be quite usable already. I haven't yet tested them because it's so fast to do the projection mapping. It takes like 10 minutes per scene, so it's not a step that I yet need to automate. But for a complicated scene, it might take an hour. So then it would be nice to have an AI do it instead.
I've talked to a lot of modelers who, if you could just get rid of the complexity of UV unwrap, they'd be so happy that they never have to do that again.
Or rigging. Rigging is close, but it's still, you kind of still have to manually touch it. But UV mapping is, I hate it. There's no joy in it. It's not something that there is though one thing that doesn't really relate to anything, but I figured out that to do UV mapping, you can, instead of doing the unwrapping in the UV editor, you can just do a morph map and then just open up the mesh in the 3D editor using the 3D tools, and then just do like a camera projection UV from the opened up version of the mesh. And that to me felt more fun, I don't know, to do than just in the 2D space try to figure out the unwrapping. But it still isn't fun. It's a tedious thing. And I'd love there to be an AI to just.
Well, I know that that a lot of my audience for this is going to be people building some of those technologies. So you heard it here from a person who's a professional working on this stuff every day. Fix UV unwraps, and you have a product to sell.
Please, please do it.
And that's a good reason why you've gone with this adventure game format as well. Yeah. You don't have to worry about the camera positioning. And we'll include a link to those tutorials that you were referring to in the show notes so that people can easily find that. I think that'll be super helpful.
That's a good
people.
Idea.
But one of the interesting comments that I heard when I shared some of the work that you've done is people get kind of naively saying stuff like, oh, well, people don't play adventure games anymore. But I think that's so completely wrong. Like, okay, so that's not necessarily a AAA game. It's not Elden Ring. But just because it isn't a game for a mass market of tens of millions of people that are going to buy that day one, that goes back to your earlier point, which is,
yeah, it doesn't need to be.
There is a market for all kinds of games, right? So you can make this game now and realize it. You don't need to sell 10 million copies. I suspect you'd be super happy if you sold a few hundred thousand copies of a game, or maybe even less as an indie game developer, right? You don't have to have those numbers to create something good.
Yeah. With the way this goes, it costs me pretty much nothing to make the game. Of course, software licenses I have to pay for and that kind of stuff, but otherwise it's free. Like, I do it as a hobby, and then once the game is out, I'm going to release the game as a freeware game, so it's not going to make a dime, which is, I think it's at the moment when AI is in its infancy, I feel comfortable making a game that's free. I think that's something that will also help me navigate the possible backlash that there might be in the community, because sometimes, like at the moment, AI is ethically in question. Like, is it okay or not? Those issues will be solved real soon, but while they haven't yet been, and while I haven't kind of invested anything into the game, it's fine to make it as a freeware project. But as you said, even if I charge for the game, if it was like $2 or $10 or whatever the cost would be, it wouldn't need to sell many copies to break even. It would have to sell one copy, and I'd be making profit from it. And I think that's the beauty of being able to use AI in the future, is to take risks, make games that don't need to sell. Like, you don't need to make the game that will be, like, you kind of have to make enough money to be able to make the next game. And if you have to make quarter of the money that a game today has to make, you can make four times more money. You can make four times the number of games you didn't originally be able to make with the same income. So the output will.
Yeah, and why? I guess my question for the world is, why is all game development need to be quote unquote professional game developers anyway? Like, maybe that'll be great for the future 250 person studios that are doing these undreamt of worlds. But I think all these sandbox environments, whether it's Roblox or Minecraft, that's shown that people just want to sit down and be creative. So maybe these tools can really open up the way for anybody to kind of play with an idea in their mind that wouldn't necessarily be a commercial project.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, like, you could make a game for yourself and just be happy. Like, it wouldn't have to have any audience apart from just you. Like, in the future, when these tools are in this science fiction state where it just say to the computer, I want to play a game that's like Super Mario, but it will have a female lead character who's a cat. And then it will just make the game for you and you can play it. Like, at some point that's going to happen. I don't know when, in 10 years, 100 years, or 5 months, who knows, but it will, the time will come. Those games won't be amazing, but they will be pretty cool for somebody who just wanted to have exactly that game. And I don't think those games will actually compete with the games that we have today, the actual AAA titles and games like that. But to be honest, of course, everything in entertainment competes with everything in entertainment. It's about people's leisure time. And so your AAA game competes with your knitting, and your Netflix competes with your throwing a ball at the wall. or taking a brisk walk. Everything, every leisure time activity, of course, is away from other leisure time activities. That's for sure.
All right. Well, so speaking of leisure time activities or any activities, we've talked about a lot of things here that you're doing. One of the things that you do in addition to all this other stuff that we've just talked about is you're working at Mainframe, making a pretty interesting looking, I call it a sandbox game. I'm not sure that's the exact words that they use, but it seems to be about shaping. You call it that too. Like, tell us a little bit about the game that you're working on, yeah, and why should people, you know, head off to Steam and wait list themselves for it right now.
Yeah, so we're working on this massively multiplayer sandbox game. I don't know what is it? Social sandbox. Mm-hmm. It's what it's called. Yeah. So it's a game. It's this like this world that we prepared for people to just live in their digital lives. The majority, I don't know, majority, but many of the founders of the company are from EVE Online. Mm-hmm. EVE Online developers who have been just dreaming of this, dreaming of a similar game, but mm-hmm. for fantasy. So having this player economy, like everything is player driven. So in the game, if you find a blacksmith who sells horseshoes, it's not an NPC, but it's an actual player who has mm-hmm. just a little shop selling horseshoes. So it's a very, very nice idea of this, like this, just this world that you can live in, which I kind of find really interesting.
Yeah, I can remember doing certain things like that in Star Wars Galaxies. We've talked to Raph Koster, the developer of Star Wars Galaxies, on building the metaverse, and of course you did stuff like that. Then I ran a little shop when I was playing Star Wars Galaxies, and it had such a compelling sandbox environment for just building towns and things where people could hang out with each other. And of course, since then we've had Minecraft, and you can build game experiences, although not in like big worlds and things like Roblox. It seems like a part of the market where there's just still a big gap. EVE Online, I played it a few times. I always remembered like the spreadsheet aspect of like figuring out all the mechanics is where you'd spend a lot of time. I'm looking forward to something where you get to kind of experience it more viscerally. So,
Yeah. I don't think our game will have
a spreadsheet,
have any of that spreadsheet stuff, that min maxing. Yeah, it's more of like an RPG where you actually get to pretend to be the character that you want to be, get to play out the life of the character instead of doing these complicated stuff like you sometimes
do. I'm curious if the work you've done on that, now as I understand it, there's no generative AI in this, it's a sandbox world, but how has the work you've done on that game maybe informed your thinking around the kinds of things you like to then work with as, call it, a hobbyist, an indie game developer? How has it informed sort of gaps and opportunities in game development?
I'm not sure. I kind of tend to do things outside of work but it has informed then, yeah. What I get to do at work, I don't usually do as a hobby. So when if I'm doing something at work and that fulfills my need to do that stuff, then when I start doing my hobby stuff, when I go to my leisure time activity, which at the moment is making a game using AI, I don't feel the need to do the same things. So it's kind of just like, it's almost like I have like my main course meal and then I just want dessert. But if I have a dessert at work, I don't want to have a dessert after. Then I maybe have some salty snacks as a hobby afterwards. So it's kind of that's how it's influencing my work as an indie dev.
So there was actually just a really interesting demo made by a guy who works at Unity showing maybe in the future shader graphs will be implemented with natural language. What do you think of the prospect of more automation and generative AI maybe dropping down a level to these things that have been pretty technical domains like shader programming? You know, it's not exactly a newbie task when people start working on graphic systems.
I think it might be a good thing. Like, it's such a delicate thing because you might make mistakes that make the game run real slow. So I think it would require an oversight from a person. And I think for me, if I would have an AI that would do shaders for me, I would just open it up and it wouldn't be perfect. I would have to look at the shader graph that it made. And I try to reverse engineer what they were doing, what they wanted to achieve with the shader. And after like 15 minutes, I give up and then I just scrap it and I do it from scratch. Because it takes me so long to try to understand what's happening in the shader that it's quicker just to do it from scratch.
Maybe that's another use of generative AI, because I've seen uses of ChatGPT, for example, where it's like, hey, explain what this program does to me, right? So if you're a shader programmer, don't lose heart yet. It's so complicated. You probably are going to spend some time learning optimizations and tweaking these things and still to learn.
Yeah. But this will, like, I think the shader programmers that are working now won't lose their job. But this will make other games that don't have a shader programmer have much more cooler shaders. Because people who don't know how to do it can suddenly do it. Like, it's not going to be perfect. And then once you start to, if you make a shader using AI, and then you have to go in and fix it, slowly you begin to understand what's happening in the shader. Slowly you begin to understand what's going on. Like, how is it working out? Like, for me, shaders were pretty straightforward because I did a lot of compositing, video compositing, before I started to work on shaders for reals. And once I understood that shaders are just the same as you would be doing compositing on a Nuke or other software, like other node-based software for compositing, it's just shader programming with nodes. And then first I did shader programming with just Notepad. But once nodes were added into the picture, it was just easy as slipping on slipping into something that you've done before. Like, it was just going back to compositing in Nuke, but in just in Unreal or Unity. Like, I've only done node-based shader stuff for 2 years now. Before that, I only did just by writing code.
Well, that's another way that people could think of these technologies is think of it as a learning tool. Maybe it won't build everything for you. Maybe it's like you said, you'll throw away the output even that it generates, but you'll learn so much in the process. I think of like the current state of AI, it's more like a collaboration. It's similar to what you said about having another team member. So, you know, you could probably learn a lot about shader programming, even from a really bad shader programmer, if you've never learned anything before, because it'll teach you how the stuff works. You'll also learn about some of these optimization problems that you're referring to, where the game's going to grind to a halt and be 3 FPS.
And sometimes there's something that's so difficult to do that it would be nice to have an AI. Like, for Echoes, I wanted to make grass that would take a pixel of an image. Like, for example, this pixel of this video screen is white, this is black. So I wanted to have a shader that takes the pivot position of a mesh, which I had at the base of the grass blade, and just colors the grass blade with that color fully. So it's like a post-process effect almost. It takes the rendered pixel and it just stretches it upwards. But to get the position from the, to make a 3D point to screen space in Unity was so difficult. There was no, I couldn't find anything online. I tried to Google it for hours and hours. It took me 8 hours to figure out the shader code, how to get the 3D position to 2D space, just by like just trying it over and over and over again. And I was just, for the first 3 hours, I went nowhere. It just didn't happen. And I just became more and more convinced that it's not possible to do. But I just kept at it. And slowly, little by little, I made little breakthroughs. And then in the end, it's pixel perfect. It gets the actual color of on the screen and it can apply it on the 3D mesh. And then you have this. So I used it for when an AI does painting and it has grass in it, I wanted the grass to sway in the wind. So now that I just paint with a scattering tool, I paint 3D grass blades on the mesh with the painting. And so it just kind of extrudes these grass blades that match the painting perfectly. And when the character walks into the grass, the shadow that's projected on the ground is picked up by the shader, and then the shadow color is on the grass. And it's just an unlit material that takes no time to process on the GPU. It's super fast. And it looks real nice. But it took me forever. And I would have been so happy to ask an AI, how do you transform 3D point into 2D space on the screen as a 2D coordinate? And just to get an answer would have been so nice. I would have saved 8 hours.
AI is a creative partner. That's what people ought to be thinking of right now, and embrace the technologies. They're there. They can really, really help you. And I think what you said earlier about your shader programming experience in this case is it's like a lot of game development. A lot of it ends up being magic in the end, and it starts out feeling very impossible at the beginning. You just have to throw yourself into so many of these things and just start hacking away and try things. So if AI can help speed up some of the hacking process to point you towards patterns or things people have figured out already, all the better. But at the end of the day, you just have to start learning, opening your mind to it, trying these things out. And game development's hard, right? We're dealing with technology and art and craft and so many aspects. If we can make pieces of it a little bit easier so that you can focus on the creative vision you have for an idea.
Yeah.
That's the opportunity in my mind.
Yeah. And maybe one helpful note for people who start making this stuff is that you don't need to know what you need, how to do stuff going in. Like, you can start working on things that you have no idea how to finish. Like, I love it when people ask me, like when I get an assignment at work, do something that you've never done before. And somebody asks me, like, can you do this? I always say, yes, of course I can. Like, why wouldn't I be able to do it? Of course, time might be an issue, but like every time I get an assignment that I don't know how to finish, I'm super pumped. Like, after this thing, I have a new skill. Like, it's the best.
Yeah, keeps life interesting. Life is not going to be boring, especially with the rate of change that these technologies are experiencing now. So UC, this has been a really fun conversation. I think everybody's going to really be inspired by a lot of what you had to share. And we're going to provide links to some of the materials that you're referring to, some of your own work. We'll point people at PAX Day. It's a game you should definitely try out. And some of these other tutorials that you referred to as well. But generative AI is here. It's here to stay. It's going to change probably every part of the game development process. And I'm so happy you were able to spend a little bit of time talking about your own experiments in this domain.